I'm going to talk about joint work with David Cribbs, who happily was visiting Lancaster last year and got me interested in things I should have looked at more closely in the past, these free semi-group algebras studied by Ken Davidson and David Pitts and many other people. It includes other examples of matrix function type, so that the classical Toeplitz algebra is no longer a lonely special case corresponding to n equals 1. So roughly what, in sketch, what I'm going to be looking at is, in this talk, is the case of a directed graph which will be countable in general, with countably many edges. And this graph will give certain partial isometry generators satisfying relations. So these will be generators coming from the edges and the vertices, edge E and vertex X of the graph. And the weak operator topology closed algebra we call LG. And in a sense, this is the first semi-groupoid algebra that comes from this directed graph G, something like the left regular representation. So I'll give some sense of what I mean by semi-groupoid in a little while. Now, these algebras are close to other contexts of interest. Muhly and Muhly-Sollel have looked at various operator algebras coming from correspondences, and one of those is they call the quiver algebra. And I think the picture there is that they have, in this particular case, they're looking at a finite directed graph or quiver, and they consider the norm closed algebra generated by these generators, and their interests are from the Hilbert module perspective, Shelov resolutions and so on, and generalizations of Berling's theorem, Wald decomposition and so forth. And another context where graphs and algebras are being studied quite intensely at the moment are graph C star algebras, in which once again one can start with a directed graph, not necessarily finite, and has generators coming from that graph, and the relations there are of various types. Usually they're of Kunz-Krieger type, meaning that there isn't a defect, a finite dimensional defect in some of the equations. So these have been studied by many people, quite an active interest at the moment. But Dave and I were concerned with the issues of the radical reflexivity, invariant subspaces and so on. So our themes were very much in line with this confluence, but they're thoroughgoingly non-self-adjoint. Now, I was a bit curious about this word thoroughgoingly. It's a pity Paul Muhly's not here, because he's a bit of a wordsmith, a word joker. He might have liked this. But so I typed it into Google and had a look around, because it was in the back of my mind. I'd read it somewhere, and it seems to be a word that that philosophers and sociologists like to use. So you'll find it, they talk about thoroughgoingly postmodern and thoroughgoingly existentialist. I think what it really means is very, you know? So I've got this word in the the introduction of our paper at the moment, and so when you read that word in our paper, it's a joke. Okay, let's look at remind ourselves what free semigroup algebras are just by looking at this example. So this is L3. That I'm thinking about here, and it acts on a Hilbert space, a Fock space, which is indexed by the vertices in red here. And it's generated by three isometries, LE, LF, and LG, corresponding to the edges E, F, and G at the top there. What's really going on is LE is a shift, and you can see it's operating by the green arrows here. So every red vertex gets moved in the green direction by LE. Then you take the weak operator topology closed algebra generated by these three isometries, and that's script L3. And this algebra, this triple of isometries, are freely non-commuting. If you take any word in them, then it doesn't reduce. So we have the free semigroup on three generators, F3 plus, is playing a role here. And a typical element in the algebra would have a finite series representation like this. And then you can close up in the weak operator topology. For the weakly closed algebra, you have a similar such series convergent in the sense of Chisaro polynomials. And one point to just bring out is a trivial observation that the set of elements of the free semigroup on three generators coincides with just the set of finite paths on this graph. Finite paths are rather trivial. You just keep going round and round, and you've got three choices each time you come back to the vertex. But it's that idea which we're going to carry over in general, that for any finite directed graph, you can consider a set of finite paths, and you'll be able to compose these paths if one ends where the other begins. And in that way, one has what one can call a semi-groupoid. And it's free in the sense of that there's no constraint on the paths that you take within the graph.
At the very beginning, where's the Hilbert space?
The Hilbert space is indexed by the vertices of this graph. So the Hilbert space basis elements are indexed by the words of the free semigroup. So the Fock space here, Fock-Hilbert space, has just indexed by in this way, and the three generators here act as shifts. So we can do something quite similar in general. So let's just look at a little simple example to see what's going on there. And in fact, there's a simple recursive way of generating the Fock space. So we're starting with a countable directed graph, G, that one at the top. And we find it helpful and fairly intuitive to write down an equivalent graph called the treetop graph, in which each vertex of the original graph appears at the very top, side by side, so vacuum vertices if you like, and they're labeled in a way that corresponds to the graph above. And then we indicate the neighbors of that vertex by downward arrows, and the range vertices will have names in this graph as well. So that's our treetop graph. Now, having this, we can then just simply by iteration generate the Fock space. So down here where we've got a minus, well, down here where we've got a 1, we'll plant this little graph here to extend things further. And in a similar way, just by repetition, this treetop graph will spawn the whole of this infinite tree, each vertex carrying a label corresponding to the labels of the original vertices. And if you want a word description, then you just follow the path down, and you can use the letters on the vertices to form a word, which is another way of describing the terminal vertex. So then the algebras we're looking at are just the same as before, the weak operator topology closed algebra, generated by these shift operators, but this time they're partial isometries rather than isometries. Now there's a great deal of diversity in this class, and even the finite dimensional algebras quite interesting. Let's look at this example. We have a graph with three vertices and two edges. So here's my treetop graph that I've written here. And actually this treetop's graph doesn't spawn anything because there are no further edges to run on. X2 and X3 are terminal vertices in the original graph. So my Fock space is five-dimensional. And the algebra itself can be realized as an algebra of matrices quite explicitly in this manner. Take this linear combination of the generators. In fact, that's already forming an algebra for all linear combinations. And the alpha, beta, gamma, lambda, mu give the structure of this algebraically, this matrix algebra. And in fact, LG is unitarily equivalent to this matrix algebra, which in turn is algebraically equivalent to this digraph algebra. So there, for various directed graphs, which are rather simple-minded like this, which have no circuits, will obtain a finite-dimensional operator algebra. And although algebraically, in this case, it's a digraph algebra, spatially, it's quite different. In fact, the game with these algebras is that the commutant algebra is often of a similar character. Well, it's always of a similar character. And commutant of digraph algebras are usually trivial when the algebra is irreducible. So, in fact, I've considered some of these algebras somewhat before in the context of limit algebras, just for rather ad hoc reasons. So I was rather intrigued to see them appearing here in a very natural way. I call them inflation algebras, because clearly there's a way you can generate operator algebras like this from digraph algebras by adding on restrictions of the representation. And these finite dimensional examples are also interesting because of the perspective of trying to decompose a general LG in terms of subgraphs of the original graph. And the way in which that can be achieved is in terms of free products or amalgamated free products of part of the graph. And some of the examples that we look at, we'll find that you can realize the operator algebra as an amalgamated free product of one of these finite dimensional things and some free semigroup algebras. Now here are two more very simple examples, just to get a bit more flavor. First of all, this G has three edges and two vertices, and a single loop, of course, gives H infinity. That's L1, the Toeplitz algebra. And so it's no surprise that because we've got two single loops here, we're going to see H infinity appearing twice. And if you go through an identification process, which I'm not spelling out here, then we see that this linear combination of the shift generators can be identified with this operator, lambda times this operator TZ, or the unilateral shift. Then we've got this is a block matrix acting on direct sums of H2 spaces. LF is just appearing as a in this block here, and LG is appearing as a shift both in this sum and down here. So when you generate the whole algebra, it looks like this. We have two copies of H infinity in the quotient. So what we see here is that we have a column of operators, each belonging to entry belonging to the Toeplitz algebra, and here we have a matrix which represents another element of H infinity, and this matrix here corresponds to this one. In this example, we see that the Jacobson radical is non-trivial. In fact, it's been blocked off with this green dotted line. So this algebra is certainly not semi-simple. And when you take the quotient by the radical and remove this, you're left with this, these two copies of H infinity, this one and this one. Now, there's a class of examples which are quite important for some of the theorems that we prove, namely the LGs that come from cycle graphs. Now, when you go through this game of trying to view Fock space as being decomposed in various ways, as direct sum of H2 spaces, in order to understand these shifts as perhaps direct sums of unilateral shift, then you come up with this representation. Let me try and explain that, what's going on there. Let me just explain what the result is rather than how you pass from go about showing the identification. So the entries are all in H infinity. So this is contained in, I suppose, 9x9 matrices over H infinity. And essentially there are 9 entries going on here, because the H11 here is a repetition of the H11 here. So if you were to evaluate this at Z equals 0, then one gets a matrix algebra which corresponds to a quotient of the big algebra, and that has a rather curious structure. And if you evaluate at any other point Z other than Z equals 0, then essentially you get 3x3 matrices. So that's a quotient of the big algebra. The interesting non-self-adjoint quotient, once you do a bit of realignment, looks something like this. So this is a rather curious finite dimensional operator algebra. And I'm not sure that I've seen that in any particular discussions of building block algebras or whatever. So I'm not quite sure how novel these cycle algebras are, but they certainly play a distinct role in the general theory. Uh, Both these examples, it's quite clearly of matrix function type, just to use a crude way of describing them. So these are the algebras which are rather like the H-infinity, the commutative Toeplitz algebra. Now, I'll give some results now that we have in our preprint that we've just about got ready. The last of these that I'm going to mention on this slide is, what is it that makes these graph algebras partly free, contain in some ways copies of L2 or LN? Let me run through some of the things we've considered. Well, the fact that these operator algebras are reflexive operator algebras was proved by Arias and Popescu, and also obtained again, and in fact hyperreflexivity was shown by Davidson and Pitts in their papers. And we've looked at this structure quite closely in the case of the LG algebras. We can come up with what we think is a somewhat simpler proof of the reflexivity of this free semigroup algebra, and which applies in various ways to these free semigroupoid algebras. So these are reflexive operator algebras. We don't know that they're all hyperreflexive, but the technique of Berkovici applies to many of these algebras, and we would guess that they are hyperreflexive in general. The commutant of a free semigroupoid algebra is unitarily equivalent to the free semigroupoid algebra of the transpose graph. That's no real surprise. We would expect that. Already in Foigelescu's papers, this kind of correspondence is well known. And the commutant corresponds to the right version of these operator algebras. What do I mean by that? Well, when you see how these generators act on the basis elements, once you've labeled the basic elements by words, then LE just operates by putting the letter E on the end of that word. So there's a left representation and the right representation of the basic graphs at the outset. Now, what makes an LG semi-simple? Well, there's quite a natural answer to that. The connected components, forgetting about the direction of the edges, the connected components of the graph should be transitive, as is the case in this graph where there's one component, and we can get from any one vertex to another by a directed cycle. That's clearly not the case for this example at the top, where we could see indeed that this radical, Jacobson radical, in some ways is being generated by the edge that's labeled F up here. So understanding these two contexts led us to the obvious conjecture, and proving this theorem is fairly straightforward. It's the technique of generalized Fourier series and working with the spectral condition for membership to the Jacobson radical. Now, here's a theorem which concerns the question, when can you put L2, a sort of basic, freely non-commuting semigroup algebra, inside an LG, which doesn't seem to be the case in these two examples. So it'd be nicest to have a simple condition on the graph which would reveal that in this sense the free semigroupoid algebra is partly free. Well, the condition here is that there should exist some vertex which has two distinct paths from it back to itself, two distinct cycles. And in that case, it seems quite reasonable that you can inject L2 using those two cycles, and that's easy to verify. And conversely, if there is such an injection, that means that there are two, if we don't demand unital, there are two partial isometries with orthogonal ranges. Then we can, starting off with that hypothesis, we can show that G must have this double cycle property. And there's a non-unital version of this as well, which in fact is a condition which has appeared in some other contexts. And the condition for unital inclusion of L2 is that there exists that every vertex should have a path to one of these two cycle vertices. Well, I don't know if this is a property that's worth pursuing in other contexts, namely the idea that an operator algebra is partly free. It somehow echoes the idea of a discrete group containing free group on two generators, which is a condition which is somewhat close to amenability or non-amenability. And also this condition here is, you might think of as being somewhat in the spirit of when a C-star algebra contains O2. Anyhow, within...
But for your investment here, do you care about the fourth space, the underlying group space, how to...
No.
No,
no. It's just that this is just concerned with when this operator algebra contains two partial isometries with a...
There's no more free structure anymore now. Just put as an embedding, right? Your free structure defined in terms of fourth space.
Yeah.
No,
this is a universal property. I mean, it's just an algebra injection, is what I require.
But originally, L2 defined not in terms of a universal property, but it defined in terms of the fourth space, the underlying group space structure. So once you back into LG, there's no more.
That's right.
No more fourth space structure. Just a kind of some algebra.
That's right. This is a property that you can define for any operator algebra. That's weakly, well, any operator algebra. That's right. That's the easy direction. If you're going the other direction, there's no preparation.
That sort of addresses Troy's question, which is that it's more than just what your theorem is, it's more than just projection. In fact, there really is a special component.
Yeah. Well, you can show that there exists a spatial component once there is such an injection. Okay, now some of the tools that we use for these results and the classification result that I'm going to come to in a moment, let me just tick off one of these. I've already mentioned the idea of a generalized Fourier series to represent an operator capital A in the algebra. Looks like this, where L of W just means the operator associated with a word in the generators, in the obvious way. And it's the Chisaro sums of this series which converge in the weak or strong operator topology. The other idea that we make use of is the fact that these algebras, like the free semigroup algebras, have gauge automorphisms. In fact, just describing what that is in the case of the free semigroup algebra. So you've got n multiple edges or loops from the base vertex to itself in that case. And we choose to introduce a new notation for the basis elements of the Fock space, namely represent them as tensors of length k when we're looking at level k, where the individual components are coming from a fixed basis of Cn. Then this provides us a convenient way of defining unitaries which respect the grading of a Fock space, which just act in this manner. So we can expand this out in terms of sum of basis elements, and we recognize what we've got as a linear combination. So that's a way of generating gauge unitaries on Fock space from unitaries which are associated with multiple paths between two vertices. Now, the most crucial technique for us, as in the Davidson-Pitts paper, which really was the inspiration for the path we took, is to understand eigenvectors for the adjoint algebras, LG or RG. What I mean by that is, you might think of the vacuum vectors at the very top of Fock space as being examples. These are vectors V for which X star V is lambda V for all X in the algebra. Well, they can be understood in some detail, and they provide the key for understanding automorphisms of these operator algebras. I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. And finally, invariant subspaces, we develop a structure theory for these invariant subspaces and a Berling theorem for them, showing that invariant subspaces are generated by wandering subspaces and making use of wandering vectors and their connection with partial isometries. Right, now let me make a little bit of a diversion, just a very brief outline, something that we've not developed too much, but I'd just like to explain that amalgamated free products seem to be a useful construction for understanding how these algebras can be decomposed or introduced. Well, of course, if we have two graphs, G1 and G2, then we can join them together at a single vertex and think of that as an amalgamation of the two graphs over a vertex, which is now common, called X. Then the free semigroupoid algebra of the composite graph can be understood as a certain free product of the component free semigroupoid algebras. Now, it's not a complete free product. We also want to identify the generator LX, which is actually a projection that comes from each of the two algebras. So my free product notation here means performing a weak operator topology closed algebra. How are we doing it? Well, here's how we do it, in brief. LG can be thought of as coming from the left regular representation of this free semigroupoid as partial isometries on a Hilbert space, the weakly closed algebra generated by those partial isometries. And this context of representations of semigroupoids is very like the context of representations of free semigroups. We can form a free product of two representations and the amalgamated free product of two representations in a natural way. So I'm going to take as my definition of the amalgamated free product the weakly closed algebra generated by this amalgamated free product of representations. So having done that, you do all the identifications. It's really not much to prove. It's all sort of trying to do the identifications in a clear-headed way. One gets this natural isomorphism here. Now, the main theorem we proved is the classification theorem, which simply stated is that the operator algebra remembers the graph. So those two question marks are actually resolved. So we have a graph which gives rise to a specific operator algebra on the Fock space. We want to then forget about the Fock space and see if the algebra alone has within it the information that can give us the graph. So what we really want is the transition matrix for the graph, Aij, indicates the number of edges from vertex I to vertex j. Now, we can write down a formula for Aij and see if this will help us in a minute. A formula which gives Aij just in terms of operator theoretic quantities. How does this work? This picture helps explain the formula. So in our Fock space, we're looking at the tree underneath vacuum vector, vacuum vertex I, and the tree under vacuum vertex j. And we're interested in the number of j's underneath I. Now, LG naught is the subalgebra generated by the shifts, forgetting about the partial, the projections. So LG naught definitely moves basis elements down the line. And indeed, if we apply LG naught to the vacuum vector here, then we'll pick up the whole Fock space from level 1 onwards. So the idea is to use the projection which goes with the vertex J to pick out the number of vertices we've got here. So we subtract off everything from 2 down, which is what we've got here, and project to the J vertex there. So these projections, the PJs, are the what I've called before the LXs. And the itself a joint part of the algebra is generated by these PJs, so we can certainly assume that that we've got control of these PJs. So this Aij is simply the dimension of that difference, two subspaces. So the problem is the following. We've got two LGs and a unitary equivalence between them, say G1 and G2. What we don't know is that this unitary, which we're given at the beginning, maps LG10 to LG20. There's no reason to suppose that this unitary respects the Fock space structure. And indeed, the unitary need not take LG10 to LG20. This is really the whole problem. And this is where we have to understand automorphisms. So let's just leave that there. So the strategy is pretty much as it is in the Davidson Pitts paper. So what's going on here is we have LG1, LG2, and there's some unitary automorphism from one to the other. And at the top of the of Fock space, we've got these particular eigenvectors for the adjoint algebra. Actually, it's also an eigenvector for RG1 star. Zeta i's. And all we know is that U, or maybe U star, takes this set of top eigenvectors to some other eigenvectors. So zeta I will go to some other eigenvector that we can't place at the moment. So we have to understand the structure of eigenvectors. Well, let's just look at this simple case of this graph where we have this Fock space for L2 contained within it on these red vertices. These red vertices, if you like, go with the two generators on this loop here, these two loops. Then, if I take linear combinations in the following manner, I will be able to construct an eigenvector. So lambda1 and lambda2 give me an element of the unit ball in C2. And with lambda denoting this tuple here in this case, and lambda1 up to lambda k in bk in the general case, we can simply write down this vector, which is sum over the basis elements with coefficients, if you like, the appropriate powers of lambda1 and lambda2, the appropriate words in lambda1 and lambda2. Then one can check that this vector, which is supported on the subspace coming from the loops at 1, is an eigenvector for the adjoint algebra. And just following the semigroup case, all eigenvectors have this kind of form. They'll be supported on these loop spaces. So now, to complete the logic of the proof, what we would like to do is to normalize, to change our original unitary by doing a unitary automorphism here to move this arbitrary eigenvector to one of these vacuum eigenvectors. Having that, then we'll be able to just use this formula to discover that the graph data for the graph G1 corresponds to the graph data for the graph G2. So really, all the work has yet to be done. It's in understanding these unitary automorphisms of these LG algebras in a sufficiently detailed manner in order to be able to see that their action on the eigenvectors is a transitive one. You can move from within a certain component, you can move an eigenvector to its corresponding vacuum vector. And that I'm assuming it's a unitary equivalence. We haven't actually looked at that fully yet, have we? No. So we were kind of stopped here. In any event, the ingredients that are needed to see these unitary automorphisms that act transitively on the eigenvectors is a Burling theorem and the analysis of wandering subspaces and wandering vectors. And that's what we do. And I think I'll stop there.